Oakbridge number 16444, Reel 2.
Mr. Malander, Reel 2.
We were talking about
how I got to crew up with John Gaunt. We call him Jono. His name is actually Wallace Stanhope Gaunt. His father was a very well-known aircraft designer. We used to just get on very, very well together. He had only one flaw in his character. He was a punster, and he would make the most terrible puns. And, you know, you could chuck boots at him when he did mosquito pilots. When they got a little bit more senior, were put in a quarter of a Nissen hut. Two of you in a quarter, and you had your own tortoise stove, and just the two of you. And you were the crew, there were four crew in one Nissen hut. That was after you were shifted out of the long Nissen hut, where, you know, pilot, navigator down two rows. It was, you know, pretty rugged living, I can tell you, especially in the winter. When John and I discovered that we were the last remaining blokes in one Nissen hut, all the others had either been posted or fallen by the wayside, we asked the mess secretary if we could have a quarter of our own. And that's how we got out of that long Nissen hut.
Where was it?
This was at Woodhall Spa.
Now, you joined 627 Squadron in July 44.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of reception did you get on the squadron?
Well, you had a very, very good reception. My flight commander was Squadron Leader Ronnie Churcher, who was very, very helpful. Told me very quickly what about the job, and I believe I'm right in saying he said, go and jump in the aeroplane and I'll show you how it's done. And he proceeded to show me how you planted a bomb from a dive onto a target at Wainfleet in the Wash. And then he said, righty-ho, well, go and drop some and see how you get on. And honestly, that was the only duel instruction I got on dive bombing in all the time that I was with 627 Squadron. It's been one of my great things, and I talk about it to people's disgust. I say, why didn't we teach dive bombing? We would have achieved even more accuracy than we did. Even Bomber Harris admitted that we achieved an accuracy even more accurate, I think it was, he said, 50% more accurate than oboe marking. Now, oboe was deemed to be fairly accurate. We were 50% more accurate than that. And this was done without, we did a lot of practice, but there was nobody coordinating the way we did it. Some of us started our dives at 4,000 feet, some of us started at 2,000 feet, some of us would pull out very, very near the ground. We were told not to go below 500 feet. There was a reason for that, because a target indicator dropped lower than that would make a splash, if you can see what I mean, instead of dropping into a reasonably round shape. It would make a pear shape, and it wasn't... you could tell whether somebody had dropped one low from the height. And I think we achieved better accuracy in the end by releasing somewhere between 800 and 500 feet. It seemed to be about the right height. From my point of view, others might have found a different thing. But as I say, nobody went into the science of it. All our practicing was done with 8.5, 10 pound practice bombs, you know, little smoke bombs. And they did not have the same trail as a target indicator. The target indicator leaves your aeroplane and then explodes, dropping the candles out, the incandescent candles, different colours, making different colour markers. They don't fall to the ground at the same rate. Do you see what I'm trying to say? Not like one small bomb which goes a reasonable trail down to the ground. This thing goes down to there, bang, and spreads out. It's a different thing. I think we ought to practice much more with small target indicators so that we got very much more accurate with them. I think we could have achieved a better accuracy. Although some chaps were remarkably good at it. My nearest, I think, was... I think the nearest I ever got to a marking point was 50 yards from the marking point at the submarine pens at Bergen in Norway. I don't recall it getting more accurate than that. And so,
how keen was the CO to get you onto operations straight away?
There was a system that if you achieved a certain bombing average with 10 bombs, at least 10 bombs on the practice range, you were fit to go. I can't recall how many days it was after I got there. I knew my first operation was to hold up our checkpoint.
We've discovered from your reference to a reference book that you, after 3 days between 17th and 20th of July.
I operated on the 20th of July. That means to say that I must have achieved a satisfactory bombing average on practice bombs on Wainfleet by day. And I must admit, I had never dropped a target indicator, a marking target indicator, until my first operation, which was at Alost in Belgium. And of course, having a baptism of anti-aircraft fire, very, very light, but quite frightening the first time. Fortunately, my navigator was very, very, very experienced man, and he said, well, you know, it's all right, it's nowhere near you. So I said, thank you very much, and that made me feel a little bit better. They used to say that you could often feel the bump of anti-aircraft fire, but that it was high-level anti-aircraft fire that interested us. We had to cope with 40 millimetre up to about 8,000 feet, and below 8,000 feet it was cannon fire, 20 millimetre Oerlikons and that sort of stuff that used to come up at you. You know, green-coloured tracer, which, quite honestly, hose piping up towards you, you could avoid. You saw it coming, and you said, right, well, I'll stay clear of that. Occasionally, you met a curtain of it. The German naval gunners were particularly good at sending a curtain up, and you had to go through that. I was hit very, very rarely on my operational flying. Very rarely. I was never hit with high-level flak, as we called it. Only cannon fire. I was hit with a Beaufort shell once, went right the way through an aileron of an aeroplane. That was a daylight raid on Falkland Island. We were trying to breach the... Or it was trying to quieten the batteries which were on the dike wall by the river. The Canadians were due to come across, and the idea was that we should be able to silence these German batteries. I don't know whether it succeeded or not. I never did discover whether it was particularly successful. I know we found them, and they were marked.
Now, when you first joined the squadron, what was the general nature of the operations which the squadron was carrying out at that time in the summer of 1944?
Well, it was, remember that it was a specialist squadron. It only went out in those days, the early days, they only went low-level visual marking. Then they used the squadron to wind find. That means to find the actual wind at the target. And that was done by aircraft dropping a marker and then flying round the marker and using instruments to calculate the wind at the altitude at which their main force would be flying when they dropped their bombs. It, all trying to get a more accurate bombing effort. And wind finding was an important part of 627's work. Very important part. The marker leader used to average the wind finding figures and pass those on to the bomber, and he passed it on, or whatever he needed to pass on, to the main force. So you had marker pilots, marker leader, who was in charge of the wind finding force. Then master bomber, we call them controllers. The term master bomber has been an overhang from 8-group days when the squadron was operating with 8-group, because 627 started off life as a flight in 139 squadron. Is that you can see the point that the first lot of pilots in the short life of 627 squadron were initially 139 low-level night strike. There's a normal level light night striking force, those from 8-group, and a lot of them didn't want to go to 5-group. They were quite happy where they were working for Don Bennett. I didn't work for Don Bennett. I went straight from training, being trained in 8-group, to operate in 5-group. What more can I tell you? The early operations, whilst I was still learning about it and being, sort of christened into this thing, I don't think that I was particularly any more frightened than any other time in my flying life. It got a little bit hairy when you've got bad weather to contend with as well. I mean, on the way to the target, of course, you could be flying through a front and you get bumped all over the place. And this is when your navigator had to trust you to do very, very accurate instrument flying. So when you came out the other side and he could read his G-set again, that he'd know approximately where he was. But don't forget that we were only allowed a couple of minutes in 600 miles error. And, it meant very, very accurate flying. And this we were proud of ourselves because it was a precise job. Not only the dive bombing part of it, but the actual driving the aircraft, handling the aircraft at precise speeds and heights, so that the navigator had every possible chance of getting you exactly there on time. And they did a very, very good job, a wonderful job, really. In fact, John never got me late to a target in all the time we were together. It wasn't until after he got injured that I borrowed somebody else's navigator, and he got me, I think it was 2.5 minutes late at the target after the markers, the blind markers had gone down. I was furious. I'd never been late on a target before, never. And this is, how one criticised oneself if you didn't get it absolutely right.
Which early operation sticks out most in your mind?
I think Kaiserslautern. Where was hit, and he got his aeroplane complete onto the marking point, unfortunately, And it was a very, very charming American boy called Buzz Brown. Bremerhaven, which was very exciting because, once again, the German naval gunners had got the 20-meter network to fly through, and that was very, very frightening for a bit. It always amazed me that you could fly through such concentrated, low-level cannon fire and not get hit. But to this day, I don't understand how it was done. I mean, I was hit twice during my operational flying. Once very, very badly flying up the, in daylight, flying up the Oslo Field. That's the one I told you about earlier. That we were badly hit that day. And the other one was over the Walcheren Island, flying at over Flushing. They flew over Flushing and then up the dike wall to find these gun emplacements.
What happened when Buzz Brown was shot down? Did you see it?
Unfortunately, yes. We were all there. He was one of the early markers. He saw the target and went, and he just didn't pull out of it. So he was hit on the way down.
Can you take me through the raid on the Norwegian U-boat pens?
Norwegian U-boat pens, yes, I can. It's one that truly sticks in my mind. We flew through bad weather all the way across the North Sea, and I had my first experience of this thing called St. Elmo's fire. Do you know about this thing? Where the whole aeroplane lights up with trails of sparks. You can't see through your windscreen. It goes opaque, a milky colour. The whole cockpit is illuminated with this very weird electric light, like very, very low-powered lighting. Does that? Can you imagine what that would look like?
Yes.
We were almost over the Norwegian coast when my navigator said, "Look, I've got a really good G-fix. Turn right," and he aimed me to fly, to go down through cloud into the field. We broke cloud with the sides of the field on either side of us. And all I had to do was just to turn gently around the corner where we knew the submarine pens were. And I went straight in, identified the target, and released. Which was our right to do. All we do is a mark of three or whatever the number was, tally-ho, and you went straight in and did your job. And then somebody would then go and assess where your target indicators landed, and then he would either call for a backup, the other aeroplanes would then come in and back up that marker that was on the ground, or if it was exactly where the master bomber or the marker leader wanted it, that was it, and he would call in the main force. And in that case, nobody else, I think one other pilot, got down there to have a look. The marker leader didn't see it because of the bad weather and, you know, the cloud and stuff around the place. And of the main force, I think only about 150 aircraft dropped their bombs. It wasn't a lot, anyway. It wasn't what you would call a particularly successful raid, other than, from my point of view, I banged it right on my marking point. And it felt good to do that. And although I felt, and always have felt, that it was my navigator's day, because he did such a wonderful job of navigating me down that fjord, I did an accurate piece of flying for him, but I think he ought to have got the medal. I got the medal. Funny, this is the way things work. I don't think the navigators got quite the appreciation that they should have done. They did an awful lot of very, very hard work, and their accuracy, I mean, we depended very, very much on their skills. It's hard to explain really how close you were, had to work together, and yet how much we relied upon each other. We were absolutely close team, very, very close team.
What were the weather and terrain conditions on that operation?
On the Norwegian field, with very, very low cloud and thick. As I say, we were, the cloud was down, I think, to about 2,000 feet. I marked and went round and told, I think it was about 50 yards away to the southeast of the marking point. Don't forget there's a marking point. Naming points aren't quite the same thing. I could explain that to you ad nauseum. The technique was you put a marking point away from where you wanted your bombs to drop, and you put an offset on your, so that they wouldn't, the bombs wouldn't put the marker out. Because obviously if you were accurate bombing, you very, very quickly extinguish the markers. Do you see the point there? So we had marking point and an aiming point, which could be quite a long way apart.
How did people know how far the marking point would be from the aiming?
Oh, this was all worked out by giving a false vector to put onto their bomb sites, the Mark 14 bomb sites of the main force.
So it varied according to the operation?
According to the operation, yes. For instance, if there was a football stadium, they were favourites for us because they were nice easy things to see under illuminating flares. But nice, if even it was half a mile away, that would have been used an offset for the aiming point. Do you see the point that it was important to get something that the marker pilots could identify with exactly.
So the stadium
that went wrong on one occasion, where my flight commander Ronnie Church and I actually marked the wrong football stadium at Munich, and we got into all sorts of trouble when we got home. And then somebody realised, well, you know, it wasn't really their fault. They were told to mark a football stadium, and they did, and we did. But it was quite a long way away from where it should have been. But it was illuminated by the flares. So the flares themselves were illuminating both both of these stadia. That was the only time that I ever remember a marking point being confusing.
Where were the submarine pens in Norway?
Bergen.
At Bergen on the west coast.
There are, yes, they were on the other side of the fjord from the town of Bergen. Because Bergen is a very big city, as you know. It's the second largest in Norway. And we're glad to say that it was on the other side of the fjord.
And what was the date of that raid?
That was the 28th of October 1944.
Now, if we could go on to the raid on the Oslo Gestapo headquarters, can you first of all give me the date of that?
That was New Year's Eve 1945. That's, what shall we say, the last day of 1944.
Can you tell me about your first introduction to the raid with the briefing as to what you were supposed to do?
The operation was sort of given to the squadron as a sort of prize, I think. It was a daylight raid, and we weren't really a daylight operating squadron. They gave us a mock-up target in the sea off Ingemels near Skegness, which was approximately the shape of the Victoria Terrace buildings at Oslo itself, where the Gestapo headquarters were. And the pilots knew that it was a building, and we thought that it was a Gestapo headquarters, but nobody would tell us very much until the actual briefing for the operation. It was tried to keep it a bit hush-hush. And then at the briefing for that raid, I complained bitterly about the operation, the layout of the operation, if you see what I mean. It was divided up into two forces. I was to lead the second force 5 minutes after the first force went in, dropping delayed 1,000-pounders. I didn't think much of the idea because it was fairly obvious that we should be flying into smoke and dust and stuff. But there we are. I was told to get on and do it. Of course, by the time we flew up the Oslo field, the German Navy, what remained of it, which was stationed there, was fully wide awake. And they gave us a pretty good greeting. In fact, every aeroplane in my flight was hit. And I got fairly badly hit, so bad that I had to hand over command to my number two because my navigator was wounded and I knew that I couldn't drop an effective bomb. Now, what else can I tell you about it? It's well recorded, that operation. We cleared the target flying over the top of a hospital which used to be the Royal Palace. And there was a Red Cross on the top of the building and also a gun post. And they machine gunned us as we flew over the top from the Red Cross. This is the sort of thing one, used to make a laugh now. But, we were very upset about that sort of thing during the war. And now it seems to have happened in so many cases, we'll almost smile at it. My navigator was pretty badly hurt. I gave him a shot of morphia in his bottom, but he managed to stay conscious right the way across the North Sea, navigating me, and I checked the aircraft's ability to land and thought it was fit enough to land. I was a bit overconfident. I tried to land with the wheels down and locked, and they had to approach very, very fast because the stalling speed was very, very high. And it was obvious that I was going to overshoot the end of the runway unless I did some braking and put the brakes on. And we did what is now termed as a ground loop. We spun round and round and round and it sheared the undercarriage off. And we finished up with a very, very badly broken aeroplane, which it did actually fly again. The pieces were collected and they told me that in about 2 months they had the aircraft back flying again, and it wasn't finally pulled to pieces until I think it was about the early 1950s. That old aeroplane all that time, an old de Havilland built Mark 4B.
Were you injured yourself?
No, not a bit.
What was the effect on Norwegian morale?
Well, it was a terrific morale booster. So we've learnt since that I have talked to Norwegians about this, about the trip, and they said it was a wonderful morale booster. But we hit the building. The first wave hit the building. One of the bombs went through the building and hit a tram. We didn't learn till after the war. In fact, I didn't learn about it till 4 years ago, that the bomb was hit a fully loaded tram, killed a lot of Norwegians. But the Norwegians are like that. They keep quiet about it. Wonderful people.
Did you have to hit a particular part of the building?
As I recall, it was the eastern